Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Today is the long-awaited day when Iowans will have their say at thousands of caucus sites across the state. Will the Bernie Revolution start here in Iowa, or will Hillary Clinton get the win she missed out on in 2008? Do Trump supporters take him seriously enough to find their caucus site and show up? We'll find out tonight, and KHOI will be covering the breaking news for you and a national audience. Tune in to 89.1 tonight or stream us live at khoifm.org. In today's show, our local talk team reports on three candidate events from this weekend here in Ames. Hillary Clinton, who appeared at Howe Hall on the ISU campus, Senator Ted Cruz at the Gateway Hotel, and Senator Marco Rubio at the Scheman Building on campus. In addition, we have Iowa campaign analysis on both sides. Laura Bellin, known as Des Moines Dem, at the liberal blog about Iowa politics, Bleeding Heartland. And David Redlosk, the political science fellow at the Harkin Center for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, who we interviewed back in the first week of January. He provides an update on the Republican race. First up, we have reporter Gail Seiler in the studio. Gail attended the Hillary Clinton event at the Aerospace Engineering Building, a beautiful space that appears to have been positively festooned with American flags on Saturday. Gail, tell us about the event, about how many people were there.
I would say there were about 500 people there, and it was quite crowded, and an interesting setting because the atrium has levels, so it was not just people on the floor, but the levels were filled with people overlooking the event. So that was quite something to see, and it was a nice energy. Should I tell you about it?
Yes, please do.
The people had to wait very patiently. The event started about 2 hours late, but it didn't seem like the excitement waned at all. One interesting thing that I noticed was I attended the Trump rally here at ISU a few weeks ago, and I saw a big difference in who was there. The Trump crowd, I would say, was about 75% men, and the Clinton crowd was about half men and half women, and there were a lot more children at the Clinton event. And there, I really didn't see any children at the Trump rally. So that was one difference. Finally, after a bit of a wait, out came Secretary Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, Gabby Giffords, and her husband Mark Kelly. Only Bill Clinton was missing, and the rumor was that he was over at the stomping grounds. So some people may have seen him
there. Yeah, I saw a lot of Facebook evidence to that fact.
As you might guess from the guest list, two themes that were emphasized by Secretary Clinton when she started speaking were family and gun control. So I thought we'd first listen to some of Chelsea's remarks.
Just could not be more grateful for the enthusiasm in the room this afternoon in support of my mom. And I am such an unabashedly, deeply biased, proud daughter. Yet the reason I am so enthusiastic for myself in supporting my mom in this election to be our next president is because this is the first presidential election that I will vote in as a mom. So when I think about who I want to be fighting for my daughter, Charlotte, who's 16 months old, and her future little brother or little sister, I couldn't imagine a stronger president to keep us safe and to help continue to advance our values and equal opportunities for every little girl and every little boy in our country than my mother. So as proud as I am to be here as a daughter, I'm even more proud and excited to be here as a mom.
After Chelsea spoke, Mark Kelly, who is Gabby Giffords' husband and a former astronaut, spoke briefly. There was a humorous sign in the crowd that said, "I'm here for the astronaut," which Hillary joked about in her remarks. But it fit quite well with the location in the Aerospace Engineering Building, that people were there not just to see Hillary, but actually to see Mark Kelly, the astronaut.
And Gabrielle Giffords is the congresswoman who
was injured in a shooting in Arizona in 2011, right? And she talked a bit about her difficult recovery to be able to walk again and talk again. So she spoke briefly and talked about why she was supporting Clinton for her gun control stance. And when Clinton began her speech, that was her first topic.
And I've been encouraged as I've been campaigning on this issue throughout Iowa to have so many people come up to me, and predominantly men, who say, you know, I agree with you. I hunt, I collect, I shoot, I agree with you. What can I do? And I said, please use your voice, speak out. Right now in this state, one house of your legislature, the House of Representatives, is with all the other important things that are facing Iowans, with some of the decisions that are hanging in the balance, particularly what I think of as a very ill-advised decision to privatize your Medicaid system and put so many of your fellow Iowans at risk. What is one of their highest priorities? Lowering the age from 14 to let more children be able legally to have guns. Now, what kind of debate is that? Because as I've traveled around Iowa the last few months, I have heard about and read about what happens when children, young children, toddlers, kids in elementary school find that loaded gun in the closet or under the bed. I've heard the stories. I've seen the news reports about the ones who are killed, who injure themselves and injure others. What is wrong with us? How can we continue to ignore the toll that this is taking on our children and our country? So please, join Gabby and Mark. Join others who are really committed to getting common sense changes accomplished. I agree with President Obama. The steps that he announced are ones that I fully endorse. Executive actions, putting more resources into the work of doing the background checks, going after the gun dealers who are so irresponsible. But none of it will stick if it's not a voting issue. And as you go to caucus Monday night, please think about this.
By speaking so passionately about gun control, it seems that she's trying to highlight her position on this in relation to Bernie Sanders, who's been viewed as somewhat weaker on gun control. So that perhaps was not surprising. She's doing that. And this was the last weekend before caucus night. So it seemed like she was also appealing to caucus goers, not just to go and vote for her, but to keep raising these issues at the caucuses, to be on the platform and to keep those issues on the front of people's minds. The segment we just heard also illustrates how she's really aligning herself with President Obama. She doesn't seem to be backing off from that association at all. And in the next segment about the economy, we hear this again.
We don't have to go back too far in history. Let's just look at our last two Democratic presidents. I happen to know both of them. And I happen to know that they inherited economic problems from their Republican predecessors. In my husband's case, it was a recession. It was the quadrupling of the national debt, an increasing deficit. When he got to Washington, he was asked, so what are you uniquely bringing to Washington to deal with our problems? And in his typical fashion, he thought for a minute. He said, well, I guess arithmetic. And he went to work to make it add up for the American people again. At the end of 8 years, we had 23 million new jobs. But most importantly, incomes went up for everybody, not just the top, the middle, working people, poor people. More people were lifted out of poverty than at any other time in recent history. And we ended up with a balanced budget and a surplus. And then what happened? Back came the Republicans with their failed economic policies, back to cutting taxes on the wealthy, getting out of the way of corporations. Well, they got what they wanted. They took their eyes off the financial markets and the mortgage markets. And you know what happened. The worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. You know, shortly after the 08 election, President-elect Obama called, asked me to come to Chicago to see him. I didn't know why. It turned out he wanted me to be Secretary of State. But before we got into that, he said, it is so much worse than they told us. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month. 9 million jobs were lost. 5 million homes were lost. $13 trillion in family wealth wiped out. I don't think President Obama gets the credit he deserves for making sure we didn't fall into a Great Depression in that deep ditch that the Republicans dug.
So she's definitely lining herself up with the Democratic establishment, with the status quo. She's putting her money in that bank, to use an economic metaphor. But she's also doing a balancing act, it seems, positioning Democrats as being very different from Republicans and herself as a mainstream Democrat, but at the same time positioning herself as different from other Democratic candidates. And when she spoke about other issues like health care, she did that also, set up the contrast with the Republicans, but also set up the contrast with Bernie Sanders, that she acknowledges the success of Obamacare, as it's called, and wanting to continue that, whereas Bernie has a different position on that. Toward the end, it was clear in her speech that she was wrapping up not just her speech, but her campaign in Iowa. And she acknowledged that she had learned from a lot from the people that she met and talked with in Iowa.
I have learned a lot crisscrossing Iowa over the last months, and I'm grateful for people who've shared their individual stories. I'm not sure I would have talked as much as I have been about mental health and addiction, about Alzheimer's and autism, if people hadn't met me at every stop along the way to tell me what was keeping them up at night, what they were worried about. Not sure I would have gone after Terry Branstad as hard as I have on closing mental health hospitals and privatizing Medicaid if you all hadn't been telling me your stories, heartbreaking stories about what you struggle with. I thank you because I have learned a lot. I am convinced I'm a better candidate, but I really believe I will be a better president because of what you have shared with me.
So that was just a sample of some of Hillary's comments from one of her final speeches before caucuses tonight. So we'll see what happens. We'll see how her appeals to the voters play out.
Well, thank you very much, Gail, for your report from Saturday's event.
I'm excited. It's my first caucus season in Iowa.
Well, get out and caucus.
Yeah. And listen to KHOI's coverage of the caucuses.
That's right. Well, someone who has been watching the Democratic race very closely is Laura Bellin, a full-time mom and activist for whom writing about politics has become what she calls an out-of-control hobby. Bellin has a following at the liberal blog Bleeding Heartland, where she has been blogging under the handle Des Moines Dem. I asked her about the Clinton-Sanders race.
I mean, a year ago, we were all wondering whether there would be any competition at all here. I think that it's incredible the amount of traction he has gotten, and I frankly didn't expect it to be as close a race in Iowa as it is. And I think it's anyone's game, and he certainly could win. I feel that the structure of the caucus system on the Democratic side does favor Hillary Clinton. And I think that there is a chance that Bernie Sanders could fall into the trap that Howard Dean did in 2004, where he had deep pockets of support concentrated in certain areas. But the Democratic caucus system favors candidates who have support more evenly spread across the state.
Can you explain that a little more?
Well, the Republican caucuses are more like a straw poll where people mark ballots for a candidate, and the Republican Party of Iowa will report how many ballots went to each candidate. But the Democratic Party will only report the number of delegates that candidates win. And so in my precinct, for instance, in Windsor Heights, we have 6 delegates to award to the Polk County Convention. And whether 50 people are there or 500 people are there, we still get 6 delegates. So if a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters really pack the room in Ames or in Iowa City or in Grinnell, there are only so many delegates they can get out of that. The Republicans fill out a ballot. They put the candidate's name on the ballot, and the results on the Republican side will be how many people marked those ballots for each of the candidates, whereas on the Democratic side, we're only going to find out how many delegates the different candidates won. And so some precincts will have much higher turnout than others. Some counties will have higher turnout than others. And I do think that Bernie Sanders has a strong statewide organization, but my sense is that the Clinton campaign has a slightly stronger statewide organization, and that's why I say the structure of the caucuses should favor her. Going to Sanders rallies, you do see a lot of people who are not the typical people you would always see at a Democratic event, and he's certainly bringing a lot of new people into the process. And the question is how many of those people will show up for him at the caucuses, and will they be dispersed in a way that allows him to win enough delegates? But there is no question in my mind that he has tremendous enthusiasm, and he's probably had 10 rallies in the state that are larger than maybe the largest Clinton rally. I mean, Clinton's had a number of rallies with several hundred people, but Sanders has had rallies with a few thousand people. He had, in July, he got more people in Council Bluffs to come to his rally than Barack Obama did like 2 weeks before the 2008 caucuses. So there is a lot of enthusiasm. And as I mentioned, I think a lot of it is because Bernie speaks in such an unconventional way and such a refreshing way. And I'm going to be interested to see whether his campaign can translate that into masses of people for the first time showing up at a precinct caucus.
Right. And Howard Dean, the other comparison that you had, was also one who stirred people up, especially with his opposition to the Iraq War, and yet that did not translate into a caucus win.
Yeah, he had a strategy that was oriented toward trying to bring out first-time caucus goers, and he had people in orange hats, you know, standing, waving signs on the street to try to get people to show up, and I don't think he did as good a job of targeting the people who actually would be there. Now, I should say that the attendance at the 2004 caucus did set a record at that time. It was much higher than the attendance had been in the Gore-Bradley race in 2000, so there were a lot of people, but there weren't enough of those first-time people for Dean to elevate him. A lot of the first-time people supported John Kerry or John Edwards, who finished first and second in that race.
Martin O'Malley is a very strong candidate in many ways. If you look at his personability, his record, why has he not gotten any traction here in Iowa?
That's an interesting question, and it's something I'm working on right now for a piece on my blog. I think that he is a good candidate. I think that this year, with Hillary Clinton being such a strong and dominant front runner, people who are not inclined to support Hillary Clinton are going to be looking for someone very different from her. And I feel that if you listen to O'Malley's stump speech, which is very solid and is generally well received and he delivers it well, he doesn't sound particularly different from Hillary Clinton. Whereas Bernie Sanders, if you've ever seen him in person or even watched on TV, but I think it comes across more strongly in person, his speech doesn't sound like something crafted by a professional speechwriter. It doesn't have a lot of personal biography. It's actually a fairly downbeat stump speech with a lot of negative, a lot of scary facts and figures. And his speaking style is very different from what we're used to hearing from a lot of politicians. And he doesn't build this kind of optimistic narrative arc. And I think that it's refreshing to people to hear something so different. And I think that Bernie Sanders is tapping more into the anger people feel about the rigged system. So I sense that that's why he's gotten a lot of traction. He's just very different from Hillary Clinton, whereas Martin O'Malley is a good candidate who doesn't seem very different. One interesting question that I'm going to be watching for is what happens with O'Malley at the Iowa caucuses? Because in a lot of precincts, he is not going to have the 15% support that you need on the Democratic side to be viable, to get a delegate. And so what's going to happen? Are his supporters going to disperse among the Clinton and Sanders camps? And if so, are they going to largely favor one or the other? Or are we going to see in many precincts supporters of Hillary or Bernie actually helping O'Malley become viable to try to help him to get a delegate so that the main rival doesn't get a delegate? And I think that's going to be a very interesting dynamic to watch.
That was Laura Bellin, Des Moines Dem, a blogger on Bleeding Heartland. On Saturday, the Des Moines Register released its poll showing Hillary holding on to her slim lead, 3 percentage points ahead of Bernie, 45-42, with O'Malley at a meager 3 percentage points. Bellin talked about how the polls differ and why this might affect the Sanders projections.
So a number of polls are drawing their respondents from registered voter lists, and some other pollsters are drawing their respondents from what they call random digit dialing. So they're just dialing phone numbers, and whoever they get who says, I'm going to go to the caucus, is in the respondent pool. And in Sanders does much, just noticeably better, significantly better in the polls that are done by the random digit dial. So some of the people in the polling field think that that may be overstating his support in Iowa a little bit, and that drawing from the voter list, which I believe is what Ann Seltzer does, who does the Des Moines Register poll, gives a more accurate reflection of who will be there on the caucus night. Now, it's possible that the Sanders campaign can energize a lot of people to register to vote. You are allowed to register to vote right there at the caucus. So it could be that Sanders outperforms his polling numbers just on the basis of the incredible enthusiasm there is for his candidacy.
So meanwhile, on the Republican side, the Des Moines Register poll showed Trump moving decisively ahead of Senator Ted Cruz, with Trump at 28% and Cruz at 23%. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is in a solid third place at 15%, with Ben Carson at 10% and Rand Paul in fifth. I spoke with David Redlosk on Saturday morning about the Republican race. David is a political science fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, who we had on earlier in January talking about the findings from his book, Why Iowa?, about the caucuses. David says he's attended over 100 candidate events on both sides to gather observations for his next book. We'll start off with David talking on that important Republican demographic in Iowa, evangelical Christians.
The bottom line is that we have a large number of candidates, and they're appealing in different lanes, as we've been calling it. So for evangelicals, where they do make up a significant portion of the caucus, every candidate tries to make some pitch there. But in this last, as we've come into it, Ted Cruz in particular has been running a campaign that looks as much like a religious revival as it does a campaign. And he's been attracting evangelicals. Part of it is his father is a well-known evangelical pastor, Rafael Cruz. And that's under the radar for the media, but he's been in Iowa preaching. And it has some impact on his son and support for his son. But evangelicals looked at Ben Carson, and that was partly how he popped up. And he's got some of the most positive ratings of anybody.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, Ben Carson is a nice guy. It's exactly how people respond. But after Paris and San Bernardino, he flubbed on foreign policy and on terrorism, and people went looking somewhere else. Huckabee and Santorum both had significant inroads with those constituencies, evangelicals. In fact, one with evangelicals in 08 for Huckabee and 12 for Santorum. This time around, they're not getting the looks. So as we come down to it, Ted Cruz is really trying to consolidate that support. Rubio is going after it as well, not as successfully. And a significant number seem in the polling to still be willing to look at Donald Trump, even though he might be the antithesis of a lot of what they stand for.
Jerry Falwell Jr. put his support behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, and, you know, the idea of evangelicals supporting Trump, I think, means essentially these are folks where they're actually putting that evangelical side of it slightly lower on the list of things they're concerned about. It's really hard to justify, if your top concern are moral issues, Donald Trump, who's been, you know, married and divorced multiple times and so on and so forth. But if you've decided that making America great again is more important in some sense, and if you're angry and frustrated and you've voted for these evangelical candidates before and it's gotten you nowhere, then maybe Donald Trump looks appealing, even if on some of the issues he's not quite where you might hope he'd be.
Now, you said that Ted Cruz, his events looked like religious revivals. Can you describe a little bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah, he did an event in Winterset a couple of weeks ago. His special guest was Dr. James Dobson, well-known. I think the organization was Focus on the Family at one point. I mean, he's been a leader on issues relating to abortion and same-sex, and a national leader for evangelicals. And he was there. There was a Christian singing group ahead of time on stage that had actually modified lyrics to a well-known song to put Ted Cruz's name in it. There were pastors there. The language was very religious language. Ted Cruz himself was talking about how believers have to get out and vote, that allowing non-believers to pick the president, you deserve what you get if you don't get out and vote. And there was all of this sort of imagery related to evangelical Christianity. It was like a tent revival more than it was a campaign event.
We also know him as the senator who shut down the federal government. Is that part of the discussion? Is anti-government part of the discussion?
Oh, it's a huge part of his campaign. You know, the folks in Washington, elites in Washington, really do dislike Ted Cruz. I mean, viscerally. He's just not a nice guy as far as they're concerned. And part of it may be that he's not. I don't know. Part of it is that he clearly does not play by their rules, which is something he thinks is a fantastic thing, and he uses on the stump all the time. When he gets attacked by Washington, D.C., as he'll put it, Washington, D.C. politicians, you know, this is a fantastic thing for him and for the people who are supporting him. You know, it's fascinating that you can position yourself as an outsider while being an insider. I mean, there's not much more inside than being a U.S. senator, whether they like you or not. And frankly, on the other side, Bernie Sanders has the same thing going on. In Cruz's case, the outsider part works really well because they really do dislike him. And every time somebody says something, he stands up and says, look how much they dislike me. Isn't that great? I'm not going there to make friends. I'm going there to tear it up and start it over. So in the end, the media has obsessed about if Cruz is likable, not to Washington folks. But when I see him in the small events here, he's been reasonably relaxed in the last few weeks and has a series of jokes he tells, and he talks to people. And, you know, he's not as standoffish or as wooden or as dislikable in real life in these small group events as the media tends to portray him.
And Rubio, he has been what people think could be the one who gathers up some independent votes.
Yeah, Marco Rubio is desperately trying to not be called an establishment candidate because he's worried that that's the kiss of death these days. And look at the other so-called establishment candidates, Kasich, Christie, Bush. None of them are making an impact at this point, at least not in Iowa. So Rubio, in some sense, he's on both sides. He wants to portray himself as that outsider, not the establishment. But he's, again, a senator, of course. More importantly, unlike Cruz, he has worked within the Senate, within the process, across the aisle, and in particular on immigration reform, which he now tries to spin rather differently than at the time that he was championing a comprehensive immigration reform. And so he's caught in some sense. Strong conservatives are not sure they trust him, partly on the immigration thing. Mainstream folks aren't sure they trust him because he's playing to the hard right as much as he can right now. But on the other hand, as a candidate, he would seem to have a lot of boxes ticked that could be really valuable. He is Latino. He's Cuban, which is different from Mexican and South American. But on the politics of identity, there's something there. He is young and vibrant. And there's some sense that if there's any Republican who could put up a good fight with the Democratic nominee, it might be Rubio. But he has to get the nomination first, and that seems to be somewhat problematic at the moment.
We're listening to my interview with David Redlosk, fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University and professor of political science at Rutgers University. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. When I first talked with David Redlosk in early January, he made the point that the Iowa caucus is an expectations game. To win, all you have to do is beat expectations. But to fail to meet expectations is to lose. So I asked him how that plays out in this moment with the 1, 2, and 3 polling slots going to Trump, Cruz, and Rubio.
The thing for Rubio at this point is they're tamping down expectations, right? The media has been talking about a battle developing between Rubio and Cruz for second place. And Rubio doesn't want the media to think he's in second place because then he can't beat expectations unless he were to win. But I think it becomes important. If Rubio does significantly better than the polling, if he's in second place in particular, he will be in much better position going into New Hampshire. Now, this leaves the Trump elephant in the room at the moment that kind of impacts all of this. The simple expectation is he has to win. If Trump does not win, then he did worse than expected, and that won't be trivial. I think, let me preface this, that I've been wrong about Trump on everything, as everybody has. But his entire campaign at this point seems to be, I'm a winner, vote for me, we'll all be winners, let's win together, we're winners, vote for me. And I don't know how you sustain that if you lose. On the other hand, what's really going to happen regardless, and this will maybe screw up the expectations game this time around, I would not be at all surprised if in the 8 days after Iowa, before New Hampshire, the media on the talking about the Republican side is all Trump all the time. If he wins, they'll talk about him as inevitable, all Trump all the time, he's leading in New Hampshire, blah, blah, blah. If he loses, they'll talk about all Trump all the time because can you believe it? He lost. Oh, no, what's this going to do? And I wonder if other candidates will even get any breathing room, whether they beat expectations or not. We'll have to see. If that's true, it'll be very different than it's been in the past.
Well, the other candidates had some breathing room the other night when Trump stood up, Megyn Kelly, at the Fox News debate. And what was that like? Did anyone emerge as a stronger candidate without Trump on the stage?
What it meant was that Ted Cruz was in the middle, and he became the target, and he did not really handle it very well, is the general consensus. The thought is that Ted Cruz had a pretty bad night at the debate. He seemed sort of hesitating at times. He tried to joke a bit, and it fell flat. He was attacked and often didn't seem to have really strong responses. You know, you came away from it going, huh, this is interesting. A lot of the media thinks Rubio had a pretty good night. I was watching with a group of Republicans. My sense was not that. I thought Rubio sounded very programmed. I thought in everything he said, it was just a clip from his stump speech, said it double time without breathing so that he could get it all in. But others seemed to think he did okay. The room I was in didn't seem to be, you know, all that excited about how Rubio did. The absence of Trump, and Trump was mentioned at the beginning, but then pretty much not after that. It did make the debate more substantive. There was more time for people since they weren't always focusing on Trump. And I think it was a better debate overall. I think other candidates got chances, Jeb Bush in particular. Jeb Bush in particular probably had the best debate he's had. I just don't think it matters, at least in Iowa at this point.
Why not? Why did Jeb Bush just not take off here? I know that he got a lot of money.
You know what? He just was not a very good on-the-ground candidate at the beginning. He was awkward. He was uncomfortable. Ways in which maybe it should matter, maybe it shouldn't matter. But when you're doing grassroots campaigning, which most of these folks don't have to do this kind of campaigning in their other campaigns, you have to be able to connect to people. You have to be able to look them in the eye. You have to feel comfortable with them. Chris Christie is incredible at that. But Christie did not make a big commitment to Iowa. He's incredible at looking at you like you're the only person in the room. It's almost Bill Clinton-esque. But Jeb Bush just seemed really odd in a sense. Now, the funny thing is Jeb Bush has gotten a lot better. I saw him 2 weeks ago, and I thought this is an entirely different candidate. It's one of the things I like about Iowa is I think candidates learn and grow and figure things out. But, you know, between the Trump phenomenon and the evangelical Christian base, it's just left him out in the cold.
Well, back to Trump. Everyone has a hard time believing that he's really leading in Iowa. I spoke with a student from ISU who said, yeah, we all stood outside the Ag Center, but we were there for the entertainment. How much of this polling can we trust?
I don't know. I mean, I guess this is what Monday's going to tell us. The Trump event against the debate, which was held at Drake, there were media people going up and down the line looking for Trump supporters to talk to and not finding them, right? I mean, it was definitely entertainment. It was definitely an event. And by the way, the debate appears to have been watched by about four times as many people nationally as the Trump event. And that may say something. That may tell us something. That may tell us that the people who actually are serious about the campaign, right, aren't just looking at Donald Trump, that he's an entertainer, not a candidate. But we don't know that yet. And I think it's extraordinarily hard to figure it out. You know, my gut feeling tends to believe that Trump supporters are less likely to be caucus goers. What we don't know at this point is whether that sense of anger and frustration is enough to propel them out to the caucuses. What's interesting about the polling is it shows Donald Trump as getting a very significant amount of support from people who have never caucused before. And if you've never caucused before, your odds are far lower of actually caucusing this time. Barack Obama got over that hump, but he did it by having literally hundreds of staff on the ground and field offices all over the state. The Trump campaign does not appear to have that.
Let's talk about that. It's a huge part of the caucus phenomenon are these offices, the people volunteering, precinct captains going around their neighborhoods, trying to get their neighbors to come with them and support a candidate. What is that like on the Republican side? Who has the strongest ground game?
Well, there are 1,681 precincts. You need captains for all of those, and that's pretty difficult to do. And I should say that the evidence is also hard to come by. That is, campaigns selectively release evidence about how their ground game's going. They don't really want us to know. So much of it happens under the radar. We really don't know. But the consensus seems to be that Ted Cruz has built the strongest operation with the most volunteers and field offices. But on the other hand, the Rand Paul people claim they have a massive volunteer base. Trouble is, it's hard to see. So much is going to happen person to person, people contacting their Facebook friends and making those kinds of connections.
That was David Redlosk, political scientist, author of Why Iowa, his first book about the Iowa caucuses. He's working on his second. David will be joining us by phone for analysis on our evening broadcast of caucus results. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOY. On Saturday, there were events for both Cruz and Rubio in Ames. Cruz appeared with several other prominent guests. There was Bob Vanderplatz, the evangelical Christian politician who in 2010, after losing the Republican nomination for governor, led a successful campaign to recall the Iowa Supreme Court justices who had opened the door to gay marriage in the state. Cruz also had by his side Congressman Steve King, Glenn Beck, the conservative radio talk show host, and his wife, Holly Cruz. Susan Franzen attended the Cruz event and got this audio for us. Here is how Cruz opened his stump speech.
You know, all of us are here today because our country's in crisis. Because we're bankrupting our kids and grandkids. Because our constitutional rights are under assault each and every day. And because America is receding from leadership in the world. And yet I'm here today with a word of hope and encouragement and exhortation. All across this country, all across Iowa, and all across this nation, people are waking up. There is an awakening that is sweeping this land. And so I want everyone to look forward to January 2017. If I am elected president, let me tell you what I intend to do on the first day in office. The first thing I intend to do is rescind every single illegal and unconstitutional executive action taken by this president. The second thing I intend to do is instruct the U.S. Department of Justice to open an investigation into Planned Parenthood and prosecute any and all criminal violations. Third thing I intend to do on the first day in office is instruct the Department of Justice and the IRS, and every other federal agency, that the persecution of religious liberty ends today. That means that every serviceman and woman has the right to seek out and worship God Almighty with all of their hearts, minds, and souls, and their superior officer has nothing to say about it. The fourth thing I intend to do is rip to shreds this catastrophic Iranian nuclear deal. And the fifth thing I intend to do on the first day in office is begin the process of moving the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, the once and eternal capital of Israel. Now that's day one.
And that was Ted Cruz this Saturday in Ames. Susan Franzen was there at the Ames rally. Susan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Susan. What was this event like? How many people were there? What was the feel?
Well, it's interesting because actually I have been a Cruz watcher since his first event in Boone. I wasn't quite as aware of the evangelical feel of it until actually I re-listened to it from recording it on Saturday. Now, the crowd on Saturday was really, really enthusiastic, and they were lined up. I got there an hour early thinking I'd need to for the press, and people were lined up waiting to sign in. And I think there were probably, at that time, probably a couple hundred lined up in the hall out at Hilton Conference Center. And so I took advantage of that to be able to interview possible supporters. And there were a few who were there just to observe or because they were trying to decide between Rubio and Cruz. Certainly no Trump supporters there. And what struck me was their earnestness, and they were really, they seemed like such nice people. I mean, there wasn't any nastiness in this crowd that I detected, but they were very sincere about how important they thought he was. And then the media was all pushed in the back on a small riser, too small for all the people. It was very, very crowded, and they were really kind of straining. And while they were straining, they were extremely nice to me and to each other, and they helped each other get feeds into the XLR box. And but what struck me just really was that it seemed like a crowd of nice, considerate people.
That's interesting because, you know, his message, when you hear it excerpted just 2 minutes as we did, is rather dark and menacing. He's sort of the sinners in the hands of an angry God motif more than, the positive preacher.
And that's why I mentioned that, because at the time, even though I'd heard the speech before, there were some nasty jokes about Hillary going to prison the first time that he dropped. He turned more of his humor to being anti-Obama and anti-regulatory. But his basic message was much more like a revival. And I didn't realize that. I couldn't hear it very well back in the back with the media because it was surprisingly bad acoustics in that room. In fact, it was so bad that during his talk, I was standing in the back crowded there with a lot of people trying to listen and a lot of media trying to get up to take pictures. And I heard Chinese behind me, and I turned around, and there was an interview in Chinese with a Chinese cameraman and a Chinese man talking. I have no idea. It was quiet in the hall. So I suppose that's why they were doing the interview there. But his speech, when I listened to it again last night to be prepared for this morning, shocked me, because from the beginning when he says, "God bless Iowa, and it's a great honor to be with all of you patriots." And from then on, it's this intense revival tone. And I pulled out a couple quotations. If we defend, take power out of Washington and back to we the people, which really struck me because at a recent Bernie rally, the song was power to the people. But it's not the same. The words don't mean the same thing.
Yes, it's very interesting. Yeah, Cruz wants to have an awakening, and Bernie wants to have a revolution, and vice versa. So we're on the brink of a great awakening if you listen to Cruz. Well, we have to move on to talk about Rubio, who was here in town. But thanks so much, Susan, for sharing your insights and a little local color there at the Cruz rally.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye. See you later. Okay, so while the two front runners, Trump and Cruz, are clearly running as outsiders, Rubio, at the number three position, is quite a bit more tame. And he brought no special guests with him and spoke only 30 minutes. There were, again, almost as many media covering the event as there were supporters. The result was kind of a staged intimacy with about 100 supporters seated in the round in the upstairs balcony of Sheeman Auditorium rather than down in the auditorium, which could have held many more. And the laughs and support expressed by the crowd were much more polite and reserved than you heard in the Cruz rally just now. And just as our commentator, David Redlosk, said, Rubio seemed to want to have it both ways, talking about anger but not being angry, and not an outsider but certainly not an establishment insider.
This anger's not new. It's been around for a while. This frustration's been building for a while. I saw it in 2010. It's why I ran for the U.S. Senate. I was a private citizen. My opponent was the sitting governor of Florida, who said he was a Republican, but I knew he wasn't. Who said that he wanted to go to Washington and oppose Barack Obama, but I knew he would go up and embrace Barack Obama's agenda. So I decided to run for the Senate. The leadership of the Republican Party in Washington, the entire Senate leadership, told me I couldn't run, and that if I did, they would go against me. But I ran, and we won. Almost the same people came forward this time in 2015 and said, you can't run for president. I said, why? He said, because you have to wait in line. To wait your turn. I said, after 7 years of Barack Obama, this is no time for patience. This is a time for urgency. This is a time for action, because if we get this election wrong, there may be no turning back for America.
Okay. That was Rubio. The sitting governor he ran against was Charlie Crist, and Rubio was kind of the Tea Party candidate in that primary and shoved Crist aside. The establishment who discouraged the Rubio presidential run, however, was most certainly Jeb Bush, who had and obviously still has his own presidential aspirations. Jeb was Rubio's mentor in politics, but with whom he's had a considerable falling out. Still, Rubio's pitch is that he will unite the party, and he's convinced some Iowans that he can. Here is just one Ames supporter who came away with that impression. There were others.
Jerry and Mary Nelson.
And you're in Ames?
We're from Ames, yep. Longtime residents here.
What do you think of the Rubio speech? What do you think of Rubio?
I think he's going to be my guy. I think after the talk today, I didn't hear anything that I didn't like, really. I've narrowed it down, to him. It was on a short list, and I think that he's going to be the one to unite the Republican Party. The other options may not be able to unite everybody. Especially Trump, he's going to polarize everybody. And Cruz, I'm not sure. Cruz is on the short list, but I think Rubio is the one to unite us. I don't think Cruz can unite us. He'd be a little more divisive, I think.
And Rubio built on this idea of uniting the party to cash in on his hardscrabble beginnings.
But being united alone will not be enough. We have to grow the conservative movement. And that means we have to go out to people that haven't voted for a conservative or a Republican in a long time and convince them of the truth, that they would be better off and our country would be better off with us instead of with the other side. And I look forward with passion to making that argument. I look forward to reaching out to Americans, for example, that are living paycheck to paycheck, because I grew up paycheck to paycheck. My father was a bartender. My mother was a stock clerk at Kmart. She was a maid. She was a cashier. I know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck, because I grew up paycheck to paycheck. I have lived paycheck to paycheck. And people in my family still live paycheck to paycheck. They're teachers, nurses, firefighters. And they struggle because everything costs more and the jobs just don't pay enough anymore. Hillary Clinton can't lecture me about people living paycheck to paycheck. I can't wait for that debate.
And Rubio kept building on this "they can't lecture me" theme regarding student debt. And then family values.
I look forward to campaigning among families that are raising children in the 21st century. They can't lecture me about that. Because Jeanette and I are raising four children in the 21st century. And we know how hard it is, perhaps harder than ever, to raise your children with the values that you try to teach in your home and in your church, instead of the values that keep trying to ram down our throat in the popular culture.
So you hear the kind of polite hesitation before the applause in that case. It was a very polite and reserved crowd. But Rubio's message struck a chord with one Ames resident, Barbara Forney, a homeschool mom of four.
People are tired of having things rammed down their throats. I think that common everyday people don't want. You know, people that can't say no about baking a cake for a gay couple, and they get fined hundreds of thousands of dollars and lose their business.
So once again, we have the populist flavor of this presidential race, the David versus Goliath theme, with, in the Republicans' case, Goliath being the government. Well, we could talk politics here for another hour or two. And guess what? We're going to do exactly that this evening here at the station. KHOI Community Radio will be hosting a national broadcast of caucus night results. And we'll hear many more of your neighbors' voices from across the state, along with national commentators like Mitch Jezerich. Our station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, is co-producing the show with the program director of Los Angeles Pacifica station, KPFK. And Ursula is here in the studio to tell us a little bit about it. We've signed up and equipped a large cast of field reporters, right, Ursula?
That's right. A lot of KHOI regular reporters and also a lot of KHOI hosts that have other shows are going to be trying their hand at reporting tonight. So it's all hands on deck at KHOI to get the word out and get on the ground coverage.
And we've even got some people in Iowa City from there.
Yes, we have folks in Iowa City that are building a radio station and they're trying their hand at reporting. And we also have made contacts with caucus chairs from different parts of the state who have agreed to let us call in, to call in and give us a report, especially from Western Iowa. We have Western Iowa Democrats and Republicans, so we're going to be really hearing from both parties, both at the beginning of the caucuses and the end of the caucuses, and then we'll be getting some on-the-ground sound from the parties, the celebrations in Des Moines of the candidates.
All right. And a couple of professionals are here in Ames from elsewhere to help us with this production.
That's right. Alan Minsky, he's the program director for KPFK Pacifica Station in Los Angeles, has come. And Norm Stockwell from WORT is driving over this morning as we speak to help co-host the show with you, Greta.
That's right.
And Greta's going to be cutting her teeth on national hosting, so good luck to you.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Anyway, WORT is in Madison, so he's driving down from Madison.
From Madison, Wisconsin.
Hopefully he'll get back before the big snowstorm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's it, folks. Stay tuned and tune in at 7 p.m. or right after you get home from the caucus to hear our national commentators and local voices talking about the results. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with reporter Gail Seiler describing the Hillary Clinton rally. We then heard from Laura Bellin of Des Moines, who uses the Des Moines Dem handle at the liberal blog about Iowa politics, Bleeding Heartland. David Redlosk, fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, gave us some insights into the Republican race. And we finished with Susan Franzen reporting on a Ted Cruz event and myself reporting on Marco Rubio with brief interviews of Ames residents Jerry Nelson and Barbara Forney. This program will be rebroadcast at noon today. You can listen to today's Local Talk Show and any of our past Local Talk Shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like KHOI on Facebook and get updates on our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Together with Richard Morrison, our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, see how much fun you can have going down to Des Moines and listening to candidates give their speeches. Contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.